To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Dig Deep Grow, the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. I'm your host, Michael McAvoy, and we're going to be talking about your future today, your financial future to be exact. Everybody knows that in order to live a full life, we have to have some money left over in order to enjoy our retirement years. And we're going to be going deep on that subject today with Andy Eshtruth. He's the author of a new book called Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. Andy works with Boston College with a research facility around the topic of retirement. So we're going to get into that with Andy right now. So Andy, thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. So first, Andy, just to tell me what you do there at the research facility with and the co-authors. You have Charles Ellis and Alicia Munell. Talk a little about the work you do and the people you work with.
Certainly. I'm the associate director for external relations, which involves communications, fundraising, and a host of other activities that help run the center. My co-authors are Alicia Munell, who is the director of our center, and Charles Ellis, who is an investment expert, independent investment expert. He does not work with us here at the center. He is formerly one of the people who started Greenwich Associates and has a lot of other investing experience and has written books on investing as well.
Okay, great. So you've got some high-powered people working with you. This book is pretty timely, I think, because there's a particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, there's a lot of people who are feeling very anxious about their retirement years. But it doesn't only extend to those about to reach retirement age. It's also the younger generations also have some issues to deal with. So I'm going to ask you first to give a overview of how you see things, with our with the state of retirement. You know, are we healthy? Do people have something good to look forward to?
Well, without any changes, there is serious cause for concern, and so I want to not be overly pessimistic in the sense that these are all situations that we as a society and we as individuals can handle if we take the right steps and we're aware of them. So part of the point of the book is to bring awareness to the seriousness of the retirement challenge that faces today's workers particularly. One of the key things that has happened is that the retirement landscape has changed dramatically in recent decades, and it's changed in a way that systematically shifts risk and responsibility for preparing for retirement to individuals and away from government and employers. Specifically, these developments include both things that are raising the need for retirement income and things that are reducing the support that workers draw from traditional sources of income when they retire. On the growing need side, people are living longer, which obviously requires more money, and healthcare costs are continuing to rise, even though they've been more restrained in recent years, which is a good sign. But they're still expected to grow faster than the economy for the most part. And that is a very salient issue for older people who, although they are covered by Medicare, do face significant out-of-pocket costs for their medical needs, and including possibility of long-term care. So healthcare expenses is a reason for the need for growing income. And a third factor is the unusually low interest rate environment that we're in right now, which has been going on actually for a while and looks like it, you know, will continue at least for some time. That means that for any given, you need a bigger pile of assets to generate a given income stream in retirement with lower interest rates. Mm-hmm. So those three factors are driving the need for more retirement income. At the same time, as I mentioned, we're expected to get less support from traditional sources than we have in the past. Social Security, which is really the foundation of the retirement income system and provides a tremendous amount of support to many retirees, is going to provide less support relative to our incomes when we retire than it did for our parents or grandparents' generation. And the reason for that is that the program is scheduled to reduce benefits as the age for full retirement goes up. The traditional age, of course, was 65. Right now, for people retiring today, it's 66. In another 10 years or so, it will be 67.
Okay.
That actually acts as a benefit cut. Sure. Go ahead.
Let me ask you to kind of try to put it into a perspective for individuals. So when you look at the average family or a person headed for retirement, how much have people saved? And, you know, is it a very small amount? Are people kind of on the way, or are we really, you know, in dire straits as far as that's concerned? Give me some numbers around that.
Well, so there are two issues here. One is that there are a large number of people who aren't saving at all, which I'll deal with in a moment. Secondly, those who are saving generally are not saving enough. And one way to illustrate this is to look at the assets that households approaching retirement have. And when I say approaching retirement, I'm referring to people between their mid-50s and their mid-60s. That group has, if you combine their 401k and IRA assets, those individuals who have a 401k account have about $111,000 saved up.
Mm-hmm.
And to some, $111,000 might sound like a lot, but when you try to stretch that over a 20 or 30 year retirement period, it's really insufficient in order to maintain the pre-retirement standard of living that you enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. So it'd be fair to say, regardless of what remedies you try to put into place, that probably the majority of Americans headed toward retirement will not have enough to navigate, you know, till the end of life. So what does that mean for how the government, how the country is going to deal with it?
So I can just conclude that point that you mentioned, mm-hmm. about how many people don't have enough. Our center has produced something called the National Retirement Risk Index, which measures the percentage of today's workers who would be unable to maintain their standard of living when they retire, given their current saving patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that about 52% of today's workforce is at risk of not having enough in retirement. And we also think that the assumptions used in that index are a bit on the conservative side.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that the real numbers could be a bit higher. So it's consistent with what you were saying. At least half of people are facing a significant challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, turning to solutions, there are a few basic solutions that we put forth. Our goal is to talk about things that use existing retirement systems,
mm-hmm.
in the United States that make it easier to implement and much more feasible. So, for example, one obvious issue is that individuals need to save more in their 401ks. And if they don't have a 401k, don't have access to a 401k, they need access to one. So within the 401k system, if all employers with 401ks were to adopt automatic enrollment and automatic escalation in the saving rate for their employees, that would make a big difference. Employees would still have the option to opt out, as they do under an automatic plan. They could decline to participate, or they could contribute less or more than their employer defaults them, than the default rate that the employer assigns to them.
Mm-hmm.
But so they still maintain the control. But basically what this does is it gives people a nudge in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And there has been experience with these automatic policies for a number of years now, and they have been extraordinarily successful at raising participation rates. Not as much on the saving side, but that's mainly because a lot of plans don't include these features that raise the contribution rate over time,
mm-hmm.
that gradually get you into a higher savings environment. So that's one area, is the 401k system. As part of that, we also think that there could be ways to tighten up access to your money before you retire. So right now you have what we call leakages, money that leaks out of your 401k before you retire. and that's because people are allowed to take money out for various purposes. Some of those channels, not all of them, but some of those channels we think should be significantly curtailed so that more money stays in the system and that you're not taking out money ahead of time. It's not leaking out. So that's what we are concerned about with respect to the 401k system. For people who don't have access to a 401k, you need another solution, and we can talk more about that if you'd like.
Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. Okay, so on that point, it sounds as if you're talking really about personal responsibility and the ability to put something in place. People left to their own devices are probably going to self-destruct their possible retirement nest egg. So you're talking about just some sensible things to put into place so that people kind of forget it, set it and forget it. Is that more or less?
Okay. That's absolutely right. And as you point out, there's an issue with people being left to their own devices because we generally, as human beings, aren't always great at making the best financial decisions for events that are occurring years and years and years into the future. People feel hard-pressed. They have immediate needs that they need to meet, and their attention tends to be focused more on those needs. Right. So the extent that you can get them saving, and as you said, set it and forget it, they're going to be in much better shape in retirement.
Right. Now, I'm going to ask you, we're going to continue down the track we're going on, but I wanted to stop for a moment and ask you, just about the history of how people have saved for retirement. In the old days, when grandfathers were working for corporations, et cetera, there was what we call a defined benefit plan, where the company would put aside funds for people without them having to take any action. Then we moved to the 401k type system that we presently have, which puts a lot more on the worker themselves to save. So I wanted to ask you, did we make a wrong turn on the road when that happened? And is there a way or another system or model that would help us to get back to something that's more predictable?
Well, it's a very good point. There were, different forces at work that led to the shift in pension systems. I would preface this by saying in some ways there are benefits from a 401k system that you didn't get from a traditional defined benefit system. And that is that the accounts are much more flexible when you move from job to job. And so it also helps short tenure employees who under a traditional pension system may never have accumulated much at all in terms of a benefit before they move to another employer. Mm-hmm. So there are some advantages to the 401k environment. But as you point out, I mean, we're basically shifted all the risk and responsibility to individuals for preparing for their retirement. And that is a matter of great concern. And that's what we're trying to do. I don't think we're going to bring back the defined benefit system for various economic reasons, but in the private sector, the defined benefit system is still the dominant form of pension plan in the public sector for state and local government workers, for example. But in the private sector, our goal is to really see what you can do within the 401k system to make it more predictable. There are even things you can do you were talking about how to make it a predictable stream of income. There are things you can do when people leave their job and actually retire, instead of just handing them a lump sum of money and telling them go figure out how to spend it over the next 20 or 30 years. You could put in mechanisms that make it easier for them to annuitize part of that money, for example, that would turn it into an income stream. So I think you put you hit the nail on the head in looking for ways to, in our view, work with the existing system, but make it a little bit more like a DB system in terms of the benefits that it provides to people and the adequacy of the saving levels.
Okay. Now the government has, come out with some proposals that would try to help in move in that direction. One idea was this idea of a thing called My IRA, where I guess you probably know better than I do, but you would be investing, I guess, in government treasuries or something along those lines. I'm just wondering if that's a little too limited in terms of getting the income that people need. Other people have suggested, hey, you know, we'll set aside money and let the market, let it work in the market. Where do you fall as far as the best, you know, funds to put money into work in?
Well, yeah, excellent question. I mean, certainly for the long haul, for most people, the opportunity to have some money in the equity market is important way to build wealth. The MIRA accounts that you referred to, the MIRA accounts, mm-hmm. are really designed, the administration designed them as a kind of starter saving account. And the notion was that you would get people used to the idea of saving, you know, low-income people, people who may not have had the opportunity or the access to saving accounts in the past, and you'd get them used to saving in a way that would hopefully be more comfortable. And if they thought that they weren't going to lose money right off the bat, it may make them more comfortable with participating. So actually what happens in those MIRA accounts is once a balance in the account reaches 15,000, it then moves into a into an IRA environment, which has a lot more options for how to invest that money. So even the administration was not trying to do this as a permanent thing that the people would save this way throughout their careers. It was really a way to draw people in at the beginning and then later give them more exposure to a variety of funds. Okay. I'm not an investment expert, but I can say that, you know, most people would advise some mix of equities and bonds in a portfolio, and that you want to take advantage of, you know, the power that equities tend to have higher returns over time.
Okay, so we're talking about the book Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. I've got Andy S. Truth, one of the authors, on the line here. Andy, you recommend three major areas that can be addressed to help ease the retirement crisis. One of them you just referred to was the idea of helping people to get into a habit of savings. Can you address one of the other areas that would help this crisis?
Well, working longer is really important for people who can do it. And I will say right off the bat that we recognize that not everybody is going to be in a position to lengthen their work life. There are people who have, you know, very difficult jobs, not just people in coal mines, but, you know, waitresses and people who are on their feet all the time and physically may not be in a position to continue to work longer than they're currently anticipating. But the economy has shifted a lot. And many of us are in service-oriented jobs. We use computers a lot more. We don't have heavy physical labor. Overall levels of education in the U.S. have gone up over time, allowing us to do higher-skilled jobs. And a lot of those jobs people can stay into for a number of additional years. And let me give you an illustration of how important it can be to work longer if you can. So Social Security allows you to access your retirement benefits at age 62 for the first time. And then essentially you have all the way up to 70 until you claim benefits. You can choose at which age to claim those benefits. If you claim benefits at age 70 versus age 62, your monthly benefit is adjusted by 75%. So you're automatically getting essentially, you know, Social Security provides what we would call in the private sector an inflation-protected annuity, gives you a stream of income that's adjusted for inflation for the rest of your life. It has built-in protection for your survivor if you're a married couple. And it you really substantially increase the size of those benefits by delaying. Mm-hmm. So that's one example that you get. The other thing is, of course, if you delay retirement, you have more time for your 401k savings. Anything you do on your own, you have more time for those savings to grow and to contribute more money to your account. And finally, the obvious thing, and maybe not always desirable for most people, is that we've shrunk the period of retirement. So if your retirement period is, you know, say age 70 to 85 rather than 65 to 85, you've reduced by 5 years the amount of time you need to finance your own retirement. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it easier when you do retire to have a more comfortable retirement.
Right. It's a little bit shorter. But yep. the way that I see it is most people have kind of accepted the fact that they're going to have to work longer. That's pretty clear in surveys, et cetera. If I'm going to feedback what you just said, it sounds to me like at a minimum, people should consider working to age 70 because they're going to get a lot more benefit from Social Security. And they're also going to be able to build their retirement funds up until 70. Now, do you think that there's a, is there a good age? Is it beyond 70? Have you found that there's a sweet spot that, you know, where people are going to really be able to comfortably handle the funds that are needed in retirement?
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. So, and I do want to say that you don't have to work to 70 to get the benefits of this working longer strategy. The average retirement age for men today in the United States is about 64. So if you're able to get to 66, 67, 68, every additional year makes a big difference. I use 70 as, and we do think if possible, working to 70, it would be best for a number of people. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is that this National Retirement Risk Index I referred to earlier is about 50% today. If you assume that people were working to age 70, that at-risk percentage drops down to something like 15%. So in other words, 85% of people of households look like they would be prepared to continue to maintain their same living standard when they retire if they were working to age 70.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there a, I just thought of, you know, we're in a country that's got widespread differences in income earning ability, sometimes based on region, et cetera. Do you guys track what goes on in various states and, you know, what whether people in certain areas of the country seem to have a better ethic about saving for retirement?
We don't really. I mean, there are researchers who have done some work on that. We don't spend a lot of time looking at regional differences.
Okay.
Sometimes due to limitations of the data that we use.
Okay. Let me ask you about other groups that are not in their imminent retirement age type of category. We've got for the younger groups, the Gen Y and Gen X coming out of college, it's quite a different picture than it was in past generations. Higher unemployment and probably prospects for saving for retirement are also different along those lines. Do you have a comment for that?
Well, you point to an important concern, which is still the fallout we're getting to some extent from the financial crisis and the Great Recession. The economy is still healing from that. And younger people finding their prospects dimmer than they were perhaps for people retiring, or excuse me, for people entering the labor force, say, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concern. Part of the reason that it's a concern is that the earlier you start saving for retirement, the easier everything is. The saving rate is lower that you need if you start earlier. Because your money has more time to grow. And so we would like to see people starting to save at 25 or whenever they first have access to a 401k. If they have it even earlier than that, that's great. So there is a concern with people getting a slower start on their careers, finding it more difficult to get employment in jobs with good benefit structures that help promote retirement saving.
Mm-hmm.
Something to be concerned about. I do think that, you know, things have been gradually improving over the last few years, and this year growth and employment prospects have looked stronger than usual. So I'm hoping that this is going to gradually repair itself.
Right. Okay. So we've acknowledged the fact that if people don't make any change, half of the population will fall short in retirement. We've also got what the government funding issues with Medicare, Social Security, et cetera, that's doesn't appear that it's going to change, at least the way that I see it. I'm wondering if there is going to be a insolvency coming. Is that addressed in your book?
So we do talk about the long-term funding challenges of Social Security, particularly. And I never worry. I've been studying Social Security for 20 years now, and I do not worry that the program will become what people refer to as insolvent. Usually what the concern that's raised is that at some point the trust fund is projected to run out of money, and then the benefits would be solely reliant on the available payroll taxes. But even in that dire situation, which is currently estimated to occur in the early 2030s, even under that dire situation, which means if we ignore doing anything for the next two decades, the program could still pay about 75% of its benefits. So it's not as if you would get nothing from Social Security. Even under a dire situation, your benefits would drop by say 25% over what you would estimate today. But I do think that eventually policymakers will act to address that long-term financial imbalance. And it's not, it's not a tiny problem, but it's not a huge problem, and it's not hard to solve. There are many ways to solve it. It would require some political will and some agreement, obviously, in a bipartisan way, to move forward. But it's a very doable thing to fix the finances of Social Security. And, you know, we suggest in our book, we suggest we would tilt more toward higher revenue for the program, more in tax revenue, because we're concerned about cutting benefits further after we've already discussed how benefits are declining right now in terms of their ability to replace your pre-retirement income. And so we would be concerned about cutting benefits back further than they already are. And for that reason, we tilt toward more revenue to help fix the system.
Yeah, if someone is, say, in their late 50s now, and they project that they're going to work till 70, so they've got some of the, like you said, some of the research behind them suggesting that they're going to do okay. How are they going to address if the Social Security program says, okay, well, we're going to cut back, we're going to make a 25% reduction in, payments that we make through Social Security. It's conceivable it could happen if there's no bipartisan effort to avoid that. But is there any way to prepare for something like that? Because this is an open-ended question right now.
Well, again, I would, obviously I can't guarantee anything, and but I would say that it's important that you lay that out. That's an important point to lay out for someone in that situation. The example you gave of someone in their late 50s who's going to be retiring, in the next 15 years or so, and what they might expect for their future. Mm-hmm. Usually any changes that are made, first of all, any changes that are made to the program usually have a significant phase-in period, and or they would exempt people above a certain age who would essentially be held harmless. Often that age that I've seen in prior proposals made by policy experts has been around 55. Is that they would kind of hold harmless people above 55 at the time that any legislation was passed. Mm-hmm. That's for the most part. So that should reduce anxiety a bit right there. The idea that people don't come to a solution, I think, is unlikely, just because there would be so much political pressure at the plight that you just pointed out, as these, people neared retirement. It actually was a similar kind of political pressure that happened with the last time there was a major reform in Social Security's finances in 1983, when the trust fund was dwindling. And that tended to focus the attention of lawmakers. And there actually was a solution that had bipartisan support at that time that did extend significantly the life of the trust fund and the program. So I think at some point, I would like it to be sooner than later. But I don't know exactly when, but I think at some point before the trust fund were to run out, lawmakers will step forward and avoid that problem.
Okay. You've mentioned that one of the major areas where you could help the system is by raising taxes. Now, the taxes are going to be paid largely by a younger generation, and they're going to have to take a bigger piece of what they earn in order to support the majority of folks, which would be, many of them in retirement. So does that pose any issues with regards to being able to, for this workforce, to be able to support that?
Well, certainly raising taxes is always a difficult proposal. There's always resistance to doing it. And obviously people, all things equal, would not want their taxes to go up.
Yeah.
So then it comes down to a matter of, would they rather have their benefits cut in retirement, or would they rather put the revenue into the system now that needs to that it needs to be able to guarantee 100% of those benefit levels?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that, if you look at polling data, it was really interesting on this. You look at polling data on Social Security over a period of years, and you see much more appetite for raising taxes. Granted, this is just answering a polling question. It's not actually doing it,
right.
But much more appetite for raising taxes than you do for cutting benefits. And I've been struck by that over a period of years. And there are also different ways that you can raise the revenue. It doesn't all have to be a straight payroll tax that affects everyone across the board. Many people have suggested raising the cap on the percentage of your wages that is taxed.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's a limitation that's around $117,000. So above that amount, people making above $117,000 are not getting taxed. Mm-hmm. They're not paying payroll taxes. They're also not getting credit for their earnings. So their Social Security benefits are not higher as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one part of a solution. One thing that my co-author, Alicia Manel, has pointed out many times is that during the period when the stimulus of a couple of years ago, there was a temporary reduction in the payroll tax rate for individuals of a couple percentage points. And what was interesting was that when that tax went back into place, when the period expired for that tax cut, there was certainly some grumbling. I don't think there was any widespread, public concern over that happening to the point that I'm not sure that people noticed it even. I mean, certainly it came out of their paychecks, but there are other deductions coming out of their paychecks, and it may be that that wasn't large enough for them to actually notice in some cases. So anyway, you do see changes like this occasionally in government finances and tax policy and spending policy. And this is one we think is doable and is better than the alternative. It's really better than the alternative of significant benefit cuts.
Okay. Andy, are you aware of any polling that addresses people's belief or disbelief that they're going to actually get benefits in Social Security in their future? I mean, there's a lot of people who feel like it's just they have to be on their own because that program won't even exist when they retire.
Yes, no, I have. And in fact, that goes back to you may have heard this, but there was a poll result from the 1990s where it said that more people believed in UFOs than would be likely to get their Social Security benefits.
Yeah.
I, as a longtime analyst, public policy analyst, those always concern me. I don't believe it's true. I know that you're right. Absolutely. People express that concern. Social Security, though, is a significant, really important program and with a lot of public support. And you don't see programs like that just disappearing. So I don't have any doubt that the program is still going to be there. I don't know exactly what form. As we said, mm-hmm. The program could see more reductions in benefits in the future. It could mm-hmm. see more increased taxes. It could see some combination. But the program is still going to be there. It will be an important retirement security program for a large chunk of the population.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one more question. But first, the book is called Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. I'm talking with Andy Eshtruth. And Andy, we've addressed the three major areas that you cover in your book. Last question is there either a single recommendation that you can make for people that would send them on their way in a real positive fashion in this area, or something that I just didn't ask that we should address?
Well, I guess I would point out one thing is there's one source of income that people, a source of saving that they do actually have at retirement, which is often unrecognized. And that is the equity they build up in their house. And so particularly for people who find themselves short of retirement savings, and they're already in retirement or right on the cusp of retirement, we recommend that people consider whether they might want to tap their home equity to help support their lifestyle in retirement to make sure that they can have a lifestyle that matches that they were expecting or anticipating. There are two ways they can do that. One, they can sell their house and move to a less expensive house. That obviously unlocks some home equity automatically. You have some extra money as a result of that transaction. It also reduces the costs associated with maintaining your house, and your insurance and property taxes are often lower as well. So that's one thing. Another option is to take out a reverse mortgage, a product that to date has not proven very popular, but has recently been reformed under new federal regulations. And we think increasingly is something that people should take a look at and think whether it might be helpful to meet their needs. It might make the difference of having a really difficult retirement or having a decent retirement for some people to tap that home equity.
Okay. One follow-up to that. You mentioned the two options. Would the reverse mortgage fall into the category of taking the decision-making out of the hands of a person? Like you were making the example earlier that when people are able to command their own retirement funds, sometimes they make mistakes like taking out money early, et cetera, like that. In the case of this last example, they could sell the house and downsize, but that leaves them with a boatload of cash that they might do something silly with. Do you think that the reverse mortgage, as it's been reformed, may actually be a better option?
It could be a better option. Yeah. I mean, you do point out that this issue about how to draw down your nest egg at retirement if you have a big lump sum of money is a challenging one. So for that reason, a reverse mortgage could be a better option. That's one reason. Although I will point out a little caveat to that is that lately we've become more concerned that people will react to having a lump sum of money, not by blowing it all in a year or two and traveling around the world, but they will make the opposite decision, and they will be so scared to spend it that they will unnecessarily restrict what they spend money on during their retirement. So that's another side of that, but it does, both of those point to challenges with people managing money on their own in retirement. I think that's going to be a difficult transition. And so for that reason, having a regular stream of income, and that's one option through the reverse mortgage, is to get a regular stream of income through your home equity is one way to go.
Okay. Once again, the book just out is called Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. I've been talking with Andy Eshtruth. He's one of the authors on the book. Andy, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been pretty enlightening.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.